Welcome to this week's edition of the Don Cherry Grapevine podcast. And people don't know, but we taped this on or record this on Sunday. And yesterday was Saturday, June 6th, and it was the 76th anniversary of D-Day.
And you'd never know it. You'd have to check the media. It was, I think it was on page 14, something like that. And I that's just a big thing with me. June 6th, an invasion of Normandy, France. And as I have to get everybody in there. When you see them getting off, the Americans show, when I was down there, I used to see them getting off all the time. And you think, they're not Americans, they're Canadians. And when it was the 3rd Canadian Infantry Division, and the guy had the camera back, he had it still. I don't know how he did. He must have put it on. And that building's still there that you see getting off all the time. And the 2nd Canadian Armored Division, the 9th Canadian Infantry Brigade, the 7th the whole deal. I've written this down, this here. Juno, as you know, was called Goldfish, Swordfish, and what was the other one? And I forget. And anyhow, Swordfish, so they call it Sword. A Goldfish, they call it Goldfish. And it was called Jellyfish. And Churchill, Winston Churchill, says, wait a minute. We can't call him. Guys getting killed.
Those are all the code names.
They're all the code names
for the beaches.
And they were going to call it, when the Canadians landed, call it Jelly. He says, wait a minute, we're getting guys killed. Churchill changed it to Juno. And it was really, and Rommel was the guy that he was brought in. He was the best general. Regina Rifles, the Winnipeg Rifles Canadian. And they had to run 100 yards across the beach. This is kind of important to me. And the only division, if you want, that reached their goal and they told they had to stop was the Canadians. And I just thought we'd put that in. Nobody knows about it. Canadians.
Well, there was almost, I was reading a thing on it that they said that it was going to be, they estimated 2,000 killed or wounded. And it was just under 1,000, so they were under on the estimate of how many were going to be killed.
And they're fantastic. One of the reasons they were training, plus they were all volunteers, and 100 paratroopers. I know my friend Mel Price would want me to put that in there. The paratroopers landed back of the attackers or whatever it were. And anyhow, I just thought I'd put that in. That's my little thing for
Well, people that don't. Like D-Day, you were saying, Cindy, was it's the opening scene of Saving Private.
Yeah, that's. I think the generations of today would know this is the opening scene with Saving Private Ryan.
Right.
And I have to say, even Spielberg and Tom Hanks said that was for movie epics, opening scenes of a movie. It's just chilling. I get chills just talking about it.
Yeah.
That opening scene, and that's what we're talking about.
That's what we're talking about. That was the opening scene. Saving Private Ryan was Omaha Beach. In Canada, Canadians were in Juno Beach, and Omaha was the toughest, and that lost the most lives. And they estimated that Juno Beach was going to be the second hardest,
yeah.
But the Canadians took it.
My friend Captain Whitey Smith, who went from North Africa up through Sicily and Italy and everything, he said that was the closest all the movies he'd seen, Rochester, New York, and that was the closest he's ever seen that. But he said it was wrong in a sense. You would never stop. If your friend best friend was shot, you couldn't stop and help him.
Yeah, that was, I remember asking him, I said, what? He says, the only thing that didn't happen, he says, was when Tom Hanks landed, remember he grabbed the guy and he was like pulling him?
Yeah.
He said that never would happen. He says, you just keep going. He says, you don't stop.
He says, you stop,
but
you get shot.
He tells a funny story that a couple of times, kind of getting on a tangent here, that you know, Whitey, he went from a private to a captain.
He went from in combat, and you know what that means, folks. He went from North Africa when they were just first joined.
Yeah, he fought Rommel there. Yeah.
And then he went to Sicily, and he went from there. And he says we could have captured all the Germans. He says
he was a captain, so he was a field promotion. I mean, so all the officers in front of him were killed, and he kept moving up the ranks.
Kept moving up.
But for all the Canadians out there, he said the Americans dislike the British, but they love the Canadians.
They liked the Canadians because they were, you know. So he was one time he was telling me a story. Him and another captain were drinking down. They were in a dugout or something, and they were drinking. And he said, late at night, they heard a tap on the door, and they opened the door and opened it up, and here's two guys standing there with an English uniform, and he slammed the door in his face, and the guy said, "No, no, we're Canadians." "Oh well, come on in and have a drink." So they liked the Canadians, but nobody liked the British. The Germans didn't like them. Nobody liked the British. I mean, they had their way. And
he told the story of remember they were pulled over. The British were pulled over.
They were in a convoy, and they were going to the British. They were on the front, and he was in charge of the convoy. And all of a sudden, in the middle of the road, all these lorries, as they call them, and that's what the English call a truck. And he said, "Geez," he said, he gets out, and here's the English at 4 o'clock. They're having tea over, and the war is going. I can hear the, you know, and he run over and he said, come on, get these things out of the way. We got to get up the front." And he said, "Oh, take it easy, Yank. The war will be there when you get there." They had to have their tea, but you couldn't beat the British, boy. I mean, and they stood all alone.
Yeah, we should.
For a while there, they did.
Well,
yeah.
They were all alone. Yeah.
Well, one day we should talk about Mr. Smith and talk about all the stuff that he told us about.
He would never tell me. The funny thing is, I shouldn't tell him if we're going to talk about him. He would never, ever talk about if he ever shot anybody. He would never, you know, and even when we were drinking, we used to go every Friday all the time. And he would, you know, all he talked about is the good things.
Yeah, well, and you imagine too, because he was right in the thick of the fighting. So it wasn't like he...
No, and he was at that Mount Casino. And you know, Tim, as we talk about Whitey, you remember the time we went fishing?
Yes.
You tell that story.
Yeah, and I still have it. So this was... A life's lesson, you know, seeing we always have the ladies.
Yes.
So Mr. Smith and Dad and I Mr. Whitey, he loved to fish, right?
Boy, he was a fisher.
So we went fishing. It was me and Mr. Smith and Dad. We were fishing, and I forget where it was. And so we forgot to bring the weights. So we got a rock. We tied it on.
Still have the rock.
And he still tied it on. So Dad, I was about 8 years old, I guess. So Dad... Kids put, you know, bait the hook and everything. And then Dad says, "Well, put your line here." And I said, "No, I want to put it here." So Whitey's watching. So Dad takes the line. He goes, "No, put your line here." And I take it out. I said, "No, I want to put it here." So Dad takes the rod again. "Put it here." And as I pull it out, a big pike comes right out of the water, goes the thing and splashes, and I got all scared, I missed the catch of the big fish. And then so Whitey went and he cut the line and he left the rock, and he says, "Tim, you keep this line to remind you, you always listen to your dad." And I still have it, right? It's on.
Yeah, I still have it, and I have it on, I still look at it, and it, you know what, it's tied up to the thing. I still have it.
People have to realize he was your best friend all through hockey, but he wasn't a hockey guy. He was your foreman, wasn't he, with Kodak Construction. He was your boss.
He was my boss.
And you and him drove to work every morning. He'd come over to the house in Rochester.
I'd have a hangover, and he'd get up, and he wouldn't be feeling, and I'd have a hangover. And 5:30 in the morning, and I'd have about an hour's sleep. And your mother would say, "There's your friend," you know. And it's all we have.
Bacardi and Coke. I remember he drank. That's what he drank.
And he wouldn't. Bacardi and Coke. And I remember one time I went in a bar, As You Like It, and I said, "Bacardi," you know. And he made a. The guy made a Bacardi, you know, with the. And I said, "What are you kidding?" Anyhow, we'll talk about Whitey another day. We should talk about. We should talk about what's going on in the National Hockey League.
Yep.
And I, you know, they're talking about a training camp, a longer training camp, and I don't believe in long training camps. I think we used to get out of shape in the and if you look back on the seasons, the guys are in shape now. I mean, they're in shape. I mean, they've all been skating. They could have a 5-day training camp and start playing the first game.
You mentioned Justin Williams last year.
Well, Justin Williams, he sat out the whole year. He didn't want to go through all that bull line. And he scored goals. I mean, he was their best player. And he was smart.
So let me ask then, so when you played, training camps really were to get in shape or not?
Yeah, we were. Because
you guys didn't train during the summer. No.
Well, we trained, but we ran.
You worked.
There was no ice around. And I remember we used to get in the skates, it would be all dry. And I remember it was terrible. You'd cut all around the inside of your ankle because, you know, you'd have to do it up. And you hadn't skated all summer.
Yeah, because they were leather boots.
They were leather.
And they dried out, right?
Oh, they were hard then.
Yeah.
Oh, I see.
Yeah. Well, they were all dried out. The guys, and you know, Phil Esposito, to this day, always says that the players in the old days used to last longer because they didn't go 24 hours. Well, you take some of the young guys now. They train, and like I said earlier. They could go right into I think in 3 or 4 days, they could go right in and start playing. Training camp, ridiculous.
But let me ask, Dad, it just seems though in your day, they weren't hurt as much. I mean, look at today. The players always seem pulled groins, pulled muscles. I mean, did you ever hear of a pulled stomach muscle when you played? I mean, really?
You know, the guys weren't really, I have to say they weren't in shape when they came, but they were in good running shape and stuff like that, but they weren't in the same shape. The very first guy I saw was in the shape they are now, where you take calipers. I think they got calipers
fat
now.
Fat calipers.
Yeah. The very first guy I ever saw was Stankiewicz's brother, Eddie Stankiewicz, Myron Stankiewicz, that's his name. And he was built like the guys are now, and he was hurt all the time because his muscles were hard.
Yeah.
They were hard. Whereas you take Phil, and he can like play.
Poor Phil.
I don't know why I'm picking on Phil.
Well, he mentioned it because he talked about it.
Yeah.
And Phil was never muscular, but he had a little bit of fat on him, and muscle would give. They would give a little, and not now.
He could take a hit more because did you ever lift weights?
I never left weights. I worked on construction. I had to go home. I went home Friday and had to start. I worked Monday. I was lucky with the Kingston Public Utilities. I used to work on the hydro. I had to start Monday because they had no money. And it was tough. But my brother Richard used to lift weights all the time. He was in terrific shape. He was a judo, black belt in judo.
Well, Uncle Rich, now he was before his time. First of all, he was a university graduate when he played hockey and everything. So.
Richard was, I used to call him professional student and because I never had any education. But he used to go to Queens. He went to Queens. He had more courses than, I mean, he went till he was 40, and he had more courses in education, and he got all the brains. And I remember he used to study. He listened to a radio with a pencil. You know, you sharpen a pencil, and, you know, tap, and he could study. And when he was, I don't know how we got on to Richard, but I remember he made the longest trip of any person. And the team was the Kingston Frontenacs. It went from Kingston, Ontario, to St. Louis, Missouri. And they only stopped, and he studied, and he was one of those guys that could get on the bus, and the guys used to tell me, as he was getting on the bus, he'd be falling asleep, and he could sleep on the bus no matter what was going on, and when he wasn't sleeping, he used to study, and I remember he played in the EPHL, let's talk about that league someday, that was a great league, it was only about 3 or 4 years it lasted, and he flew in. And he got the tying goal against. I played for the Sudbury Wolves, and he played for the Kingston Frontenacs. And they flew him in. He landed on Ramsey Lakes up there. It was all ice, and it was awful. This talk doesn't sound too good to Richard and I, but we had a few beers all night, and I drove him to Ramsey Lake. He got on the plane, flew to Kingston. This is no kidding. This is hard to believe. Flew to Kingston. Landed about 7 o'clock. Went to college. I mean,
well, Uncle Rich is what you call a Renaissance man.
Yes,
he is. And people see he's a Renaissance. Very few people are Renaissance men.
And define a Renaissance.
A Renaissance man is a person who is good in everything.
That's about
basically.
It.
Basically, and yeah, they're smart, and they're good. They're artistically good. They're good in sports. And you look at Uncle Rich. I mean, he played hockey, made the National Hockey League.
Did.
He was good in, well, he was judo. He was a black
belt in judo. First man, but there's only four.
And then...
he was taxidermist.
And then carving the ducks. I have ducks in my house with him. And he used to win blue ribbons at the Royal Winter Fair all the time.
What he did was, everybody had the wood duck. I remember this here. And he said, well, I won't do the wood duck. I'll do the female duck. And he won first prize.
And that was a big deal. When a a female duck decoy beats the fancy schmancy male plumage that are lots of colors, that is a real credit.
So
his carvings, the feathers look real. They were so unbelievable.
Well, I said to Aunt Lil, I said to her, I said, when did Richard take up taxidermy? He had a grouse. The tail was so thin you could see through it. You know how like a feather.
Yeah.
And then he was a 50-50 shooter, like a bang. You know, like
a skeet shooter.
And he used to make his own.
I don't think bullets. He was a taxidermist.
No,
he wasn't a taxidermist.
No, so let's get
like
that straight. He didn't do that. He was a. It's Come a wood, wood carving. Wood
Come co- to think of it, I never did nothing.
And then, well, you were a good artist.
You were a good artist. I remember in Rochester, in the basement, you used to do cartoons up on the wall and paint them. And they were unbelievable.
I never did anything like him.
He did everything. And then Uncle Rich, and then he became a principal. He was a teacher and then became a principal. So when people say you're a Renaissance man, like Uncle Rich, and there's...
I didn't know what a Renaissance man
that
was.
He was, and he well, we should talk about like he and he's kind of like you. He's got that cherry gene in him that he's a little nuts.
Little nuts, yeah.
Just talking about training camp. I don't know. We got on to Uncle Rich, but
well, he used to lift weights too. The top of it, he used to.
Well, I brought it up in saying that he would go running. We won't call it jogging.
Oh.
Because I know you get upset when you call it jogging. He would run.
He ran like he was the first guy, and the only one, I've only known one other person that run. What he used to do is we used to be embarrassed. We used to run up the fairgrounds, but he used to run, and he would walk, then he would jog, and then he'd go for 100 feet, pull out, and I used to and I'd be jogging around, and I said, how come you do it that way? And he's right.
That's right. Well, nowadays, that's what
hockey
they say.
Is 100 is a burst, and more so now. It's a burst. It's not like jogging around. You see guys jogging around. It's good. Better than nothing. But he used to Ace Percival was the guy we used to follow. I don't know whether he did or not. But he'd go 100 feet. You couldn't go any faster than he'd go. And then he'd jog, and then he'd walk.
Yeah, so Uncle Rich was always ahead of his time.
He was. He was always, and I was always behind. But I said, we started this whole thing, is that what I'm saying is that the players don't need a long training camp. And they're in shape now. They're ready to go. And here's a big thing, too. Another thing, too, a lot of people don't realize. If I was coaching the Boston Bruins and we were playing St. Louis and we were in the finals and we went to the finals and I don't know who went. Let's say we hope that Boston wins the Stanley Cup. And now there's going to be no space. When do they start the season? Do they start the season? And they're going to start it shortly. There won't be any rest in between. Now, do I want the schedule maker to give me a break at the start, or do I want to start the regular season? If I am the coach, I want them to start the regular season because I'll give them the days off, and you have to have a lot of to give them the days off. I do not want halfway through the season all of a sudden playing three games in a row. That's when the injuries come. So I would rather have the players tired at the start of the season. And believe me, they're going to be some of them are one two. There's two teams going to be pretty tired at the start.
Yeah. So you're saying if it's Boston St. Louis in the finals, and they win, Boston wins the Stanley Cup, then 3 weeks later, 2 weeks later, they might be good and right in the middle of a 60 or an 80 game schedule again. They'll have no rest.
I would rather have it that way, then have the schedule maker, you know, give us a couple of breaks and then play a lot of games in a row later on. So I know it's kind of complicated, but the whole thing is pretty complicated.
So can I ask, if they want to get this over with to get on to the new season, why wouldn't they do best out of five instead of going best out of seven?
No, well, they're, or are they?
No, they're. It's not 100% done. What they're talking about, first round is best out of maybe three out of five, and then after that, it's best out of seven because they want to make legitimate, right?
Yeah. So it's not going to be legitimate. I don't care what you say.
Because they say, you know, they don't want to have three out of five to win the Stanley Cup, because the whole thing is you got to win best out of seven.
And there's going to be a lot of hockey, boy. There's going to be, they seem to go to seven games. Going to be a lot of hockey. And the team that wins it and the two teams that are in, they're in the finals are going to be pretty tired.
So one thing, Dad, that we did, you put a Twitter out on the, this week that got a lot of...
What was it?
Well, you put out that the Buffalo Sabres had three fights this year. It had less than 20 hits a game. Imagine that. Less than 20 hits a game.
Holy smokes. And Boston and St. Louis used to have that in a period.
And you said you felt sorry for Jack Eichel, and this is the ninth year that they missed their role in the playoffs. And then, I don't know, a lot of people agree with you, and a lot of people disagreed with you for some reason. But
disagree with me?
Yeah, well, they were saying, oh, just because they didn't fight, just because they didn't hit, doesn't mean they didn't win. But what you put in the tweet was, do you think maybe one of the 19 guys that got less than 10 goals would get mad and drop the gloves or throw a hit or do something?
Well, I hate to say it again, and I don't want to, you know, be an advocate of violence, but Boston did, when we're in the finals, did lead the league in fights. And and St. Louis, I know Binghamton was the guy that won it, but they had everybody hit. And I think when that whole series changed, when Krug got hit in the corner, remember he got hit in the corner?
He knocked him down and he knocked his helmet off.
And he got up and he ran and he hit a kid named Thomas. Remember that?
Yep.
And put him out.
Eh?
Put him out, yeah. Now that I think of it, St. Louis said, whoa, this is how you want to play the game? And Berube is the... And I watched him back in the bench. He never got excited. He never said much. In fact, I said to him on the elevator, I said, you never get upset when you get a bad penalty. He never said anything. Never get upset. He's saying it. So, and when he hit Thomas, and everybody changed in St. Louis.
Yeah,
and,
well, it looks like it almost... And you have to give credit to the referees back then that they let them hit.
There's another thing, too.
They let St. Louis hit. I remember, I think it was Game 7. The one guy had the one Bruin down on the ice and was giving it to him, and there was no penalty.
Well, even the Europeans are getting suspended for head hitting for St. Louis.
Yeah.
You know, here's one thing that really, really, really bothers me with this playoffs. I'll tell you what really bothers me. We're into this here, is that the referees start calling the playoffs like they did in the regular season. If they ever start that, Toronto is laughing, and a few other teams are laughing. But the reason everybody loves the playoffs is that, and I hate to say it, is they let up a little on the, they don't call it chintzy penalties, like little hook and a little hook here, little hook there. And if they ever start calling the playoffs like they do the regular season, you know, it'll ruin the playoffs.
But Dad, you better be careful in saying that there's a difference in refereeing, because the high ups and the management of the referee be saying, oh, and ask the referees, do you call it different and all that? They may not like that. You know what
no,
I mean?
I know.
They might say, you know, call it the same way, but there's definitely a difference.
The playoffs are supposed to be a war. That's what the, and I think Punch Imlach called it hockey is a battle. And if you don't go into it like it's a war, and that's the playoffs, to get to the finals, it always was a war. And I'm a little worried that the referees, you know, they start the season and they'll start the playoffs and start calling those chintzy penalties. That will be murder, but it'll be good for Toronto, though.
Yeah. Well, anyway, but the Buffalo, I mean, there was, you know, it.
Buffalo, I know. Buffalo, you know, I love Buffalo. They have great fans there. I remember we used to go in there.
Well, the Yard was a great building.
Oh, it would, and they had the best glass of all.
Oh, I know. He just leaned up against it.
Well, you'd hit a guy and it'd rattle.
Were you coaching when Sean Felt and...
No, that was the year before.
Yeah. Well, if you go on YouTube and you use Google on YouTube, Jim Schoenfeld and Wayne Cashman, they hit
in the corner, in a Zamboni corner, and the thing, they broke the thing that held it, and they went down the hallway fighting.
The door opened up the Zamboni, and they started fighting in the hallway.
Well, they had the year I was there, when I coached the Boston Bruins, they had a great day of the French Connection line,
That was your first game you coached.
Oh,
was Buffalo, and I think you lost 9-5 in Gilly.
9-5, and I'm sitting at the back like a fool. Last time I ever sat at the back, and my goalie, Gilly Gilbert, is sitting in front. He said, "Well, that's it for me." And I'm kind of listening. He said, "There goes my average." I said, "Holy shit. Here I am, my first game, and then little wee guy with a bubble helmet, I'll never forget, got a hat trick.
Danny Gare.
I said, what have I walked into here? This is the Stanley Cup champions in the finals, and I get hammered the first game.
Well, I remember, too, in Buffalo in the odd, they used to have, and they don't do it now for any reasons. Yeah, they used to have...
The crowd seemed to be into it more.
Well, in the odd, they used to have a thing. Whoever had the best sign that they hanged got tickets to the next game. And then I think they said then they had the one. And remember the one with
Hugh? Oh, yeah. The one they had... Hanging, and whoever had the best sign got to the finals. You know, always so the best sign. It was voted the best sign. Cherry and Wensink, goon with the wind.
I remember
something
that.
Like that. Anyhow,
yeah, that was, yep.
And that won the best sign. It was a big. It was pretty.
I mean, I can remember if they were televising a Buffalo game, I would tune in. Not that I care about Buffalo, because they would show those signs on TV. It was very entertaining.
And you know, the crowd seemed...
It was a loud rink.
And it was a loud rink, and you banged in the corners. And
the time that... I remember we were losing, and we came back and won in the third period, and Greg Shepard, Bobby Schmatz, and was it Donnie Marcotte, got the 1-2-3 stars.
They got 1-2-3 stars. I thought this was the best. So I thought I'd come up and see how they'd act. And what they did, this is no kidding. I don't know whether you're a kid or not. Used to do in the snow. They grabbed each other's elbows, and they went around the rink like a locomotive, like that.
And we
used to have fun. I had more fun there than any place. And when we'd win, which we usually did, they had a pretty good club. They had French Connection line.
Yeah, and Jerry Korab, Schoenfeld, and
they had a good. They had a real good.
Do you keep in touch with Rene Robert and still?
Well, I used to. I don't have Rene Robert, but
used to love blue, the original blue. Boy, they liked each other.
My original blue only liked two people. You like Whitey, and I think it was the aftershave or something.
Yeah. And Rene
Robert.
Yeah.
Anyhow, Buffalo was...
Well, and it's sad to kind of see that they're nine years in a row.
And I cheer for Buffalo every time. And I called because, remember, he gave me the... I used to talk about the GTHL all the time. And as a joke, we had our pitcher taken. I still have that. I see that.
Yeah,
pitcher.
Well, you brought... that was that draft year with McDavid and... Was it McDavid? No.
Yeah, it was McDavid.
Yeah, McDavid and all those guys. And
Sheriff.
And that was... you're on Hockey Night in Canada with them, and you know, like, you used to introduce the players on Hockey Night in Canada, all the up and coming draft picks.
I'd always show the GTHL, and he gave me I still have it, a beautiful USA hockey. They used to wear.
He says, "Here, Don, this is for you. Thanks for all the USA hockey support."
Yeah, Keuchel, and I kind of feel sorry for him because
he got into a couple of fights this year, and they didn't give him a penalty for it. I forgot who he fought. He got a 4 minutes, but you know, you just feel sorry. But and, you know, we'll talk about Buffalo and some of the strange moves that they made. Well, trading Ryan O'Reilly, remember he wanted out and the whole deal. But the one thing I didn't understand was a guy named Matt Molson. He played for the Islanders.
You knew his dad too.
Yeah, and he played for the Mississauga Braves, deep Double A, and then he eventually made it to the National Hockey League. And
I don't think he was drafted.
No, I don't think he was drafted. I think he kind of got was a walk-on. He's always one of those guys that was a bit of an underdog his whole career.
And we cheered for him because we knew
because we saw his dad a lot. We were out in the rink, and his dad was always nice to come over to say hello and stuff. So in the 2016-17 season, he had 14 goals and 32 points. So right now, that he would have been would have made him fifth this year in the with Buffalo. And he had 11 power play goals. And only 10 other players in the league that year had more power play goals. And then the next year, sent him to the American Hockey League.
I don't know. I never figured out why they didn't like him there. He wasn't a rough guy or anything like that, but he could put the puck in the net.
Yeah, he had 11 power play goals. I mean, he was only seven guys in the league had more power play goals. And you wonder, and they let him go. It's because you get the stupid reporter saying, well, you know, he only scores on the power play.
Well, no, the best one of all, and I knew we were going to talk about him, is Jason Allison that played for Toronto. I mean, he led the team. Well, I forget how many points he had.
2004, 2000, or 2005, 2006, he had 60 points. 60.
60. 60 points! I mean, if you get 60 points now, you make $10 million.
And he had 39 power play points. 39.
And they say, oh, yeah, but, and the reporters say, oh, yes, but the only, he's not that good. He only scores in the power play. Only scores in the power play? I mean, who cares how he gets points?
So if he scores 100 points on the power play, that's no good. And then next year, right out of the league. Gone.
So do you think that the GMs actually listen to the reporters? Do you think they have influence?
Oh, absolutely. I mean,
what, for public relations?
Don't ask me, but the power of the press is very, very important. I found that out when I was with the Mississauga Ice Dogs, and the pen, as Shakespeare said, is mightier than the sword.
But the thing is, I can see the fans listening to the press and being influenced because most of them don't know what's going on. But for a GM to listen to the press.
Believe me, they listen to
the amazing.
Press. It's amazing. I know when you're on Hockey Night in Canada, you listen to the press. Yeah.
But there's one guy.
One guy.
This story is like one of the most unbelievable stories in hockey.
Is Paul Gardner. Now, I remember this game. I watched the game. He did cross-check.
This was 1981-82.
Yeah, and he's the son of Cal Gardner, and he's the brother of Dave Gardner, and his name was Paul Gardner.
And he was playing for Pittsburgh at the time.
He's playing for Pittsburgh, and he cross-checked Dougie Smale. I think it was Doug Smale, and I watched the game. And a guy came in, a real tough guy, big guy, too, which is a big, tough guy. And broke his jaw in three places. Just suckered him. And I don't think Jimmy Mann ever recovered from that either.
No, he got a 21-game suspension. That was, at the time, I think that was the longest suspension ever.
Yeah, I felt sorry for Gardner. He was having a good year. So, and he still led the power play goals. He was a specialist on the power play goal.
So he played 59 games that year because he broke his jaw.
Yeah.
And he still led the National Hockey League and power play goals.
Now he comes back the next year in 1982-83. I'll put the name. He got 20 power play goals. 20 power play goals. He had 55 points. Tied in the league with Al Secord with the power play goals. And then he was gone. Right?
Yeah. After that, the next year he was in the American Hockey League.
Yeah. How do you figure a guy tied in the league with power play goals, and then he doesn't make the
For 2 years he led the league in power play goals. The second year he was tied, but so you could still say he led the league. For 2 years in a row, he led the league in power play goals,
and he's gone.
And he's gone the next year in the American Hockey League.
No, he went. No, let me just tell you what he did. I remembered. I wrote this out. He went to the American Hockey League. He played for the Binghamton Whalers, and he had 100. He scored 130 points, and he was the MVP.
Of the American Hockey League.
The American Hockey League. You know, next season, he played for the Rochester Americans. Get this. He got 112 points, and he was the MVP again, and then he was gone. I mean,
he needs a new agent that will only have a one-way contract.
It was unbelievable to me to watch this kid through the years The MVP 2 years in a row, get power play goals, and they get rid of him. I could never understand. And he was a good guy, too.
Yeah, and it just, there are a lot of really weird stories when you look at it. Like if you were a guy now that had 20 power play goals and 55 power play points in the National Hockey League, you'd be getting
$10
million. $10 million, and he was out of the league.
I think the only guy... You and I had a little discussion about this. He was the guy, Paul Gardner. But I think the guy that I can't, it just boggles the mind was my buddy, Bobby Schmatz.
Yeah.
And the last year he played in the National Hockey League, get this, the last year he played, he had 26 goals and 26 assists. He had 52 points, and he didn't play again in the National Hockey League. Now they don't. They wouldn't get if they get 26 points. They get $3 or $4 million.
Yeah.
But he had 26 goals, and I asked Harry Neal. I said, Harry, he was a coach at the time. I said, how come you 26 goals? He said, I couldn't handle him. I had a tough time with him. Every guy that was on the club that was having a tough time, he'd come in and fight for him. And that year was Dennis Kearns. Remember Dennis Kearns, the defenseman?
Yep.
And he said, I don't know, I was benching him or something. And he'd come in all the time and give me a hard time. He'd say, why you been, you know, and someday must go on Bobby Schmatz.
Well, we talked about him. Well,
I got more stories on
Bobby. But he did that with you.
He did that with me.
Yeah.
And I remember we were in Atlanta. We went to a bar called The Wharf. I'll never forget it. There was Jerry Cheevers, and Brad Park, and somebody else. I forget. Anyhow, it doesn't matter. They wanted, and I'll tell you the story. They wanted Daryl Enestrand to make the club. He was a defenseman, and not Stan Jonathan. And because Stan was, and he knew it was a favorite, and my favorite, and Stan hadn't. I think he played about 4 or 5 games. He hadn't had a fight. And he was going up and down a swing. He was nothing. And Enestrand, I got to admit, was a pretty good defenseman. But I had my defense set. And Schmatzy was there. You think he would give up on Daryl Enestrand? He bugged me. You know, he'd come in. I mean, I could tell you stories about Schmatzy. And Daryl and Doak, one day, can I tell a story? I'll tell you a story about Doak. This is a funny one. Gary Doak. Gary Doak was one of my defensemen. And... I remember he weighed about 175 pounds, and he'd run out and hit guys, and he was hurt all year. So I told him in front of the team meeting, I said, if you hit another guy, well, that's my job. You're hitting guys 200 pounds, and you're only 170. So anyhow, he played, I could tell you a lot of stories on Daryl and Gary Doak. But he was a guy that Schmatz had come in, and he said, he was like the – straw boss. He was voice for everybody.
Well, a quick thing though was Stan. The guys were, and then Stan got into a fight with Moose DuPont right in front of the bench, and I think that kind of changed things.
Yeah,
That was Schmatzy was always a handful. That's for sure.
Oh, I could tell you more stories. I think I'll write down all the stories, and we'll talk about Bobby Schmatz some more.
Yeah, so we'll end it up here, and I think next week we're going to talk about a guy that was one of my favorites on Hockey Night in Canada, and now is the head of the NHL alumni, Glenn Healy.
Oh, Glenn Healy. Yeah, they put him down between and everybody that was any good, they put down in between. I used to put in between the penalties. Or no, the penalty box and the...
Well, between the benches they used to put.
Yeah, between the benches. And everybody knows the worst view of anybody in the whole building is the coach, because, you know, you're down there, you're in amongst the players. And there he puts, Glenn Healy was down there, and I used to feel sorry for him because he was a good color guy.
Yeah, he was. Him, Al Strachan, and I don't care, I like Mike Milbury.
For sure.
They were my three favorites.
Well, I'm one of those bad people. I like listening to people's opinion on hockey that played the game as opposed to a lot of other people that give their opinion.
Yeah. So we'll talk about Glenn Healy next week, and we'll wrap
it
up.
He's a player. He's the head and president. And I'll say one thing, one thing about him before we leave. And we should talk about Glenn Healy, best backup goaltender of all time. He used to keep them loose. He's the head of the players'
alumni.
Alumni, and He made 190 calls, if you can believe it, 190 calls to anybody over 65 years old, 190. And when he said Kenny Dryden, it was a little longer than Kenny can talk. And he's slow, as we know. Yeah. But boy, Glenn Healy, boy, he was
thought you were going to say his claim to fame is that he plays the bagpipes.
No, I'll get into all that stuff later.
That's what I thought his claim to fame was.
No, his claim to fame was he was a great backup goalie, and now he's the head of the alumni, and what a good job he's doing.